Welcome to the Storage Stories Podcast, where Deanie Burns and Jason Coonan tackle self-storage news, trends, education, and share their expert experience in both the U.S. and Canadian markets. This podcast is for rookies and seasoned veterans alike as we all try to grow our businesses and leave our mark on the self-storage industry.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Storage Stories. I'm Deanie Burns, the Chief of Staff with Sunbird Storage. I have with me Jason Coonan, the CEO of Sunbird Storage, and Travis Morrow, who is the CEO of National Self Storage and Store Local. So today we are going to be talking about what's going on with rates in self-storage. But before we do, I want to kick it off with some important things happening in the industry. So the hurricane update, Modern Storage Media did an excellent update on what self-storage is doing to help one another out and also some of those who are affected. So they also put a great link where you can donate and help be a part of the relief efforts. And I will say Sunbird is collecting donations at our Winston-Salem, North Carolina facility, non-perishable items, in conjunction with the nonprofit called Human. So thank you for donating. Thank you for your generosity. And also Extra Room Self-Storage, I saw, is also helping out with hurricane relief efforts. So thank you, everyone in self-storage, for all that you have done to support the people who were impacted by Hurricane Helene. And our prayers are with those who, for Hurricane Milton in Florida. So I introduced Travis Morrow. Thank you for being on our podcast, Storage Stories, episode number 4.
So thank you for having me, Deanie. I appreciate it.
So Travis Morrow has been on a mission to modernize the self-storage industry since he started in 2004. In 2019, Travis was appointed by the Store Local Board of Directors to become the CEO of the Store Local organization. He has overseen the transformation of Store Local into a profitable organization focused on supporting the independent owner-operator to stay competitive in a rapidly consolidating space. In 2023, he negotiated and now oversees the acquisition and modernization of Modern Storage Media. We love that magazine, by the way. And the longest running voice of the self-storage industry is what it is. So great team that they have there. They're doing great things for self-storage. So thank you for that. Along with Travis's other accolades and accomplishments, he was the president of the Arizona Self-Storage Association Board of Directors at one point. He also served on the self-storage National Board of Directors for 6 years. He is currently on the Board of Directors for Tenant Inc. And he was a founder of the Self-Storage Association Young Leaders Group. So thank you, Travis, for all that you have done for our industry and all that you are doing. So now I will hand the mic over to Jason so that Travis and Jason can talk about rates and what's going on in self-storage right now.
Thanks, Deanie. Really glad to have you, Travis. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Jason.
We're very impressed with your background. You've got a heck of a lot more experience than I do, that's for sure. And looking forward to learning some of your strategies today. For those of us who don't know you as well, give us a little bit of background. Kind of tell us maybe a little bit how long you've been in self-storage and how did you get started in this industry? I mean, I know each of us has kind of a unique story as to how we came across self-storage. Some of us grow up in it. Others, have career changes. Some of us stumble into it. But, yeah, how long have you been in storage?
I started in self-storage in 2004, officially. Actually, the semester before that, I was a finance intern with National Self-Storage. And for my internship, I was doing and created a competition analysis database for, at the time, the 93 stores that National Self Storage owned and or managed. Created a database out of Microsoft Excel. But I've been interested in self-storage pricing literally from the beginning of my career. Since then, started out doing feasibility studies for third parties that were interested in developing self-storage, which is where I learned kind of what it takes to pick the right spot for a storage facility. 2009, when the Great Recession hit, we consolidated our home office, and that really got me into operations and accounting. For many years, I actually did the accounting for all of our third-party managed stores, which gave me a great understanding of, you know, the bill pay process and what it takes from a software standpoint to get, you know, your revenue out of your property management software and into your accounting software, and then paying the bills and processing the reports every month. And still to this day, while I don't pay the bills anymore, I still do all of my end of month reports for all of our stores, and I schedule the emails to go out to the owners every month. 2013, we joined a group of independent owner operators that started Store Local. It was literally a group of independents that said, literally none of us are big enough to do this on our own when it comes to competing with the REITs. They just have much bigger bankroll, much bigger budgets to be able to buy or build the products and services that they use at their stores. And so Store Local was created, and it still is today, a group of independent owner operators that work together to buy or build the products and services we all use at our stores on a daily basis. That led to, you know, going down the path of property management software, which has led to the creation of Tenant Inc. And, you know, we've been building property management software now since 2019, all largely funded by independent owner operators. And so the same mantra has held through, that none of us are big enough to do it on our own. And so by working together, we've been able to create what we feel is, you know, the best converting online rental process all the way down through property management software and facility management that we as operators want to use. And so, yeah, I've worn a lot of hats in the industry. I'm certainly no longer young enough to be in the young leaders group. I aged out a few years ago, but you know, at the time was happy to be involved in that. And, you know, that group is still growing today. So it's all very exciting.
Yeah, that's quite a journey. And as you've articulated, there's a lot of parts, right, in that ecosystem that have to work together. You've got all of your site level operations. You've, of course, got all the tech. You've got the brand. You've got software, revenue management. It's a far cry from somebody who's just getting started, right, with one location, no brand. About maybe a little bit, you know, the founding of Store Local, I think, you know, certainly resonates with me. We put a lot of stake into kind of our brand and to the recognition and to the power of kind of building, you know, a platform with multiple locations in terms of the marketing, then having the money to come behind it and build a site that converts. But you were some of the early, you know, believers or adopters, right, in a co-op and a brand. Talk a little bit about that, because there's some, you know, competitors, I would say, that don't seem to value a brand, and they have, you know, sort of a hodgepodge of companies and names that they run under versus, you know, yep, the power of more of a singular name.
And we determined that by, you know, and we determined by kind of looking at what Google prefers, because the power of the brand ultimately is to get you where Google wants you to be, or and where you want to be on Google. And that is totally GMB, you know, first page is less and less significant, but, you know, Apple Maps, all the places where branding is important, Google values. And they've now said as much, that, you know, if you are a larger national brand, their algorithm is going to pick you up as more valuable to the search results that they are offering to potential tenants. So if you were in the hotel business, for example, today, you said, all right, I'm going to build my first hotel. You would not go and name it Jason's Hotel or Jason's and Dini's Hotel, because in the hotel industry, you've got the five big brands and then all of their sub brands. And so you would go and you would choose your, you know, start at Marriott. Do I want Marriott, Hilton, IFG, IHG? Pick your top brand and then pick your sub brand. And that's what you're actually going to call your hotel. And they're going to put in the work and the effort on the marketing side to drive traffic to your individual location to get you room nights and fill up your hotel. Well, I've said forever, the self-storage industry trails the hotel hospitality industry by 15 to 20 years. And not only life cycle from a marketing standpoint, but just kind of how we've been trailing along. And so we learn a lot from the hotel industry from self-storage. And so if I'm looking at the hotel industry today, we're saying, where is the self-storage industry going to be in the next 10 or 15 years? Well, chances are we're going to be in a very similar situation. So today you've got your Publix, your Extra Spaces, your U-Hauls, your Cubes, and all of the big REITs. And there's going to be a handful of other brands that are successful in branching out, but it's not going to be mom and pop's self-storage, unfortunately, forever. And so we created the Store Local Storage brand to allow especially the individual operators to be able to fly a flag of a national brand, which is up to 92 facilities now, but still be able to run their own small business. And, you know, we handle the marketing SEO side of things for operators. We're all on the same software platform so that we can provide them unified benchmarking and reporting so they can see how their store compares to other stores flying the same flag. We give them a best practices playbook, but it is not a rule book for the operator. And so we took store operating manuals from some of the top store local operators and cherry picked the best practices from all of them, put them into this playbook. And we share that with store local storage members. And it literally takes them from how to open your store on day one, all the way through operations, reporting, accounting, all of the things that you need to do to run a successful self-storage facility. And it's especially for the little guys that are just looking to get in the industry, the way that they can come in and kind of skip ahead of the daunting task of selecting, you know, what is the best property management software? What's the best way to do your website? What's the best call center? What's the best? You've got all of these parts and pieces that we've kind of pre-selected for them into a package, and we call it operations in a box, and we hand them the box and say, let's, you know, rock and roll. How can we help?
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, very valuable platform and service that you're providing to your members. They're not only getting the administrative functions and the tech, which of course is so hard to develop and build on your own, but like I said earlier, I think they're also getting the use of that brand. And
so that brand is an optional program for store local members. So we've got store local members that fly multiple different flags. So I've got National Self Storage and I've got A Family Storage that I operate, which is 30 stores. There are many other operators that fly their own flag, still using the tech and tools that we've created and the buying power that we've created as Store Local. But Store Local Storage is just, you know, it's a product that we offer our members that can be advantageous to them. I've been talking about the small guys. We have two portfolios, 20 and 30 plus store portfolios that also saw the writing on the wall from a Google standpoint and converted their larger portfolios to store local storage as well. So it's not just for the little guy. It can be for anyone.
Wow. How many stores did you say they had in those portfolios roughly?
One had, mid 20s. The other was 30,
wow.
32.
Yeah, no, that's a lot. I think, maybe they just, chose to leverage some of the things you guys have already sort of perfected. But certainly if you've got one or two locations, it's not easy, right? As you said, to compete. So
yeah, no, and
piggybacking on what you guys have done is definitely going to give them a leg up.
From a domain authority standpoint, if you come onto Google with a domain authority of one with a single store, unfortunately, you're just not going to get seen. And so by bundling 90 plus stores under the same flag, our domain authority is in the 50s. And because Google gives deference to larger brands, you're going to show up quicker.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So 20 or so years in the industry, you've certainly seen it change. I'm sure there's been different eras. Certainly,
no doubt.
There was a lot of characteristics to it in the early 2000s. There was kind of the pre-pandemic era, which I didn't participate in. I wasn't even in the industry yet. The pandemic had its own characteristics. And certainly now things have been a bit more difficult in some ways. How would you characterize the market today? Very different in terms of operations, pricing strategies. We're definitely at a bit of a crossroads in some ways.
Well, yes, and you're correct. I've lived through a couple cycles now. Before the Great Recession, I would go to industry trade shows and everybody, there may as well have been champagne bottles popping, like everybody was excited. And then 2008, 2009, the Great Recession happened. It got tough, but self-storage proved our resilience and our recession resistance through that Great Recession. And then, we were moving along, pumping out our annual rent increases, becoming more and more popular, more and more valid as a commercial real estate sector. And then the pandemic hit and nobody knew what was going to happen and nobody could have predicted what happened for self-storage as a result of the pandemic. Those were some of the best years as an industry. And it feels horrible to say, but the math is the math, that the industry has ever seen and may ever see again. I mean, occupancy spiked, revenue spiked. You could push hard from a revenue management standpoint. And coming out of that, we knew that couldn't last forever. And what I'm seeing today is just a trend back to normal. Occupancies are still high. Revenues, if you're lucky enough to hold your revenue flat, you're doing all right. If you can, maybe get a 1-2% bump, you're doing great. If you get the normal 5-6, you're killing it. But we're just regressing back to normal as far as I'm concerned. And so, we had to come down from the high. It couldn't have just kept on going forever. And so while it feels like a decline, and it is mathematically, if you look pre-pandemic, we're kind of just back to normal. And so, however, as a result of this getting back to normal, what I had noticed back in January was that some of these REITs were getting creative with their pricing strategies. And we can, talk about why that is and what, or at least why I think that is. But that has propagated over the past year and become more and more prevalent across the industry that, you know, the rate is the new promotion. You know, I'm seeing prices on 10 by 10s in some of the markets that we're competing in, you know, that are mid 1990s rates. You know, a 10 by 10 for $60 is not a thing. And our customers don't know that. They just see that a 10 by 10 is $60. And then they get hit with some very aggressive rent increases. And it's, you know, I felt was not a great look for the industry. And so that's why I wrote a series of articles about it in MSM. I just wanted to kind of point it out that, hey, maybe this isn't the greatest look for us as an industry. We don't want to get the same kind of ick factor on us like used car salesmen have, for example. If you call someone a used car salesman, it's not intended to be a compliment. And so from an industry standpoint, which I've been in a lot of those roles that you mentioned, Deanie, I've been fortunate in my career to be able to think about the industry as a whole and kind of over and above my own operations. And so I look at a lot of things as, you know, how is this going to impact the industry and not just my business, but everybody's business.
So for anyone who hasn't yet read these articles, very well written. You're laying out kind of the case as well as some of the data, you know, which we'll touch upon. But anyone can find them in MSM, Modern Storage Media. Travis Morrow wrote a three-part series. The first one is Aggressive Rate Hikes, Part 1. And then there's several parts after that. So going through the pandemic, we had occupancy in some cases, many markets. There was a lot of, you know, people were moving pretty frequently. So the demand for storage went through the roof. We saw occupancy, you know, 95% plus. So now it's receding, let's say, closer right to 90%. And as a result, some operators have used rates as the new promotion, as you articulated. So why do you think that they've gotten so aggressive on the rates? What are some of those reasons, in your opinion, for doing that? Because clearly it's a bet, obviously, on the ability to raise rents over time. But why would someone engage in such a aggressive, you know, strategy?
So this is my opinion. I haven't gotten, nor would I ever get, a confirmation from any of the REITs on this strategy, but they are in a weird spot as a publicly traded company. And it's something that I don't have to deal with, that you don't have to deal with, where the public are your shareholders. And your public is also your potential investors. And so it is my opinion that the REIT stock prices are very heavily tied to the occupancies of their portfolios. And if you've got Joe investor that doesn't know anything or understand anything about the self-storage industry, but he is interested in investing in a publicly traded company, he's going to look at some very basic top line kind of information about a portfolio or a company. And one of those things that gets reported every quarter is their occupancy. And if I'm an unsophisticated investor and I see that a company's occupancy is declining, whether it's from an all-time high or not, I may or may not be as inclined to buy stock in that company, or I may want to sell stock in that company because it appears that they are not performing as well. And so one way that a publicly traded company can fight to maintain their occupancy is to kind of give it away at the front and try and attract as many people as they can to come in, you know, rent a unit, the unit shows occupied, their overall facility occupancy remains high, and then I'll handle the revenue over the course of the next few months. And so I really believe that the pricing plan that these REITs, you know, one started and others copied as it usually goes, is driven by wanting to defend their occupancy for the purposes of maintaining their stock price. It is a whole different world than you and I have to deal with, as I mentioned. And I think that's driven it. The unfortunate thing for us as operators, they've also proved that it works and that it can work, which is what led the others to follow suit, which is then trickled down to us as operators, the independent guys that have to compete with these REITs at some of our facilities to figure out ways to stay in the game with these guys.
Yeah, I think this is really nothing. I mean, it's a bit of a new technique, but the focus, the obsession with occupancy, right, has been going on, you know, at least as long as I've observed this industry. You know, tactics like first month free certainly is a good way to fill units, you know, and it doesn't really help your economic occupancy, but, you know, physical occupancy.
It will next month.
Yeah. If they stay, right. You know, it's that kind of vanity metric, first month, a dollar, things like that. But I guess I'll push on you a bit when it comes to saying, you know, that they've proven that it works. Now they have data certainly that might indicate that, you know, some customers will accept an aggressive rent increase after just a few months. But I would argue, you know, I would at least whether I could argue that it doesn't work, I'd like to, but I could at least argue that it might be too early to tell, because some of those strategies were rolled out late last year. And then as this year has progressed, revenue income for many operators on their same stores has declined. So can you really conclude that this bet on having low rates and being able to get aggressive on existing customer rent increases does work? I mean, when you say work, what do you mean by work? I mean, is it increasing their finances or is it simply increasing their occupancy?
I believe at least over the last few quarters, you know, and again, we're only just getting into the fourth quarter of this year and they haven't even reported third quarter results, which will be interesting to see. But at least for the first two quarters of this year, occupancies have held on pretty steady for the, at the REIT level, right?
Okay. So when you say it worked, meaning you're saying that they were able to sort of
stem
the tide on occupancy. Okay. Gotcha.
If their goal is to defend their occupancy, then I believe it has worked for them. Now, does it work across many other levels? You know, what is the economic impact when you have to wait, you know, 90 days, 6 months to get somebody up to a market rent? Of course, that's going to have an economic impact to the negative for them. But from a defending your stock price by your occupancy standpoint, I think it has worked, at least for now. I think that I would like to believe that they are starting to recognize that it may not be the, just because we can doesn't mean we should, is what I keep saying. And, you know, I talked about in one of my articles and I had a store competing with an Extra Space. And 1 month starting at the end of last year, I had noticed our velocity of move-ins drop off significantly. You know, since we'd opened, we'd been renting a unit a day, just like clockwork. And all of a sudden that dropped down significantly. And we started investigating what was happening. And then we found out what Extra Space was up to with their new pricing model. And so we're like, crap, we're going to have to do something. So of course the knee jerk initial response for us was we're going to go match and we'll just do what they do. And we had to kind of customize the software a little bit to even be able to do what they do. Because we were that far kind of behind, if you will. But as soon as we did, my velocity of rentals increased again. Now I'm in the unfortunate position of renting 10 by 10s for $60 or less versus the $165 that I was getting before. So it's still not a great position to be in. But again, the REITs have a very significant advantage over the individual self-storage operator, and that is their number of stores and the data that that number of stores affords them. And so I was talking to an operator that owns a facility managed by one of the REITs, talking about this very topic. And he had recently met with them and they shared with him, again, this is third party, but I believe him, that on that first rent increase they send out after they move somebody in for super cheap, they're going to hit people with 100 or 120% rent increase. And if they, and they only expect to keep 75% of those people. If they keep 75% of those people, they are winning. And they know that because they've been able to do the testing across all of their thousands of stores and A/B test different scenarios and do different things that we as a, you know, a portfolio of 30 could never hope to do. They know that if they get 75% of those people to accept the increase, that they're ahead of the game. Now, what about the other 25% of the customers that were abused badly? And, you know, it's not a great look for the industry as a whole. And those people start talking and that conversation propagates to us becoming the used car salesman of the real estate world. And that is something that I wanted to caution everybody about because, you know, what I did the same thing. I did 108 rent increases. It was the meanest I have ever been to a group of customers in my, at the time, 19 years in the industry. And 108 rent increases, we had 20 move out. According to their rules, I'm ahead of the game. And we ended up, you know, we had the 20 that moved out, 40 some took the full increase, 40 some we negotiated a slightly smaller increase with. But overall, we increased our revenue on that group of 108 people by 56%. Financially, just as a finance math guy, that's a win. It's something we had to do because this is a new facility in lease up, and renting 10 by 10s for $60 was never going to pay the mortgage. And so, you know, we felt it was a necessary evil. I still don't know that I would do it that aggressive ever again. It just didn't feel good. But at the same time, you got to pay the mortgage.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I've heard, you know, other prominent, you know, storage operators, midsize operators talk about them coming to the same conclusion themselves. They felt like they tried to hold the line on pricing and, you know, month after month went by and their results were impacted and they, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, capitulated. Ended up going into the same type of strategy. At least at Sunbird, we've only got two locations open right now in North Carolina, but you know, we've still got 10 by 10s, depending on the floor. They're anywhere roughly from, you know, 170 to 250 a month. So they're, you know, they're kind of not in that game. And part of that is because we also, you know, guarantee no rent increase for a year. So,
right.
We're probably the last one standing on the game, but I understand the situation that it it puts you in. So when you've got to offer a unit for $60 or $50, what does that look like to the customer? I know from your website, you've taken a step in the right direction of disclosing it by saying it's an introductory rate, I believe is the is the term. What does that mean to the customer? I wasn't able to find what that means other than it just says introductory rate. So there's a little bit of a caution, but what are they to expect?
So you, I'm glad you caught on to that. That was one of the things that we learned from that first 108 unit experiment, was that we could have done a better job explaining up front what was going to happen with the customer, that they weren't, you know, we know what market rate is in our industry. The customer doesn't know what market rate is in our industry. And so we needed to do a better job of explaining both on the website and in the office through our managers that this is a great rate that you're getting, and we're happy to give it to you now and meet your need for self-storage when you need it right now. However, that is not a rate that is going to be available to you forever. And so I don't spell it out exactly, you know, if it's going to be 90 days or 120 days after you move in, when your rate's going to go up, because that can change based on some of our revenue management settings. And what's going on with individual unit sizes and occupancies and that sort of thing. But we do try and tell them up front that, listen, this is an introductory rate. It was the best term that we could figure out to try and encapsulate what was going on for the customer. But generally how it works now is if a customer moves in today, they move in at a 10 by 10 at $150. Their first increase is going to be heavy, and I'm going to probably double it, because that still only moves them up to $100. And then I'm going to hit them again, you know, 6 months after that with another increase. And that increase is still going to be, 25 to 35%. And I'm still at a 35% increase on a $100 unit. I'm still $20 a month under market. And so after that 6 month increase, in a perfect world, I'd wait 9 months and get them up to market rate. And we haven't been in the game long enough. And you mentioned the game earlier. That's what we call it at our company. We call it the game. And so my managers know that if their store is playing the game or not, because some stores don't have to play the game. They don't have an extra space or a REIT in their neighborhood, so they don't have to worry about and play the game. But we've got some that have a public and an extra space right next door, and they're really playing the game. But no one has been playing the game long enough to fully understand the longer term timing. But it's not, we're going to take you from 50 to 150 in one rent increase.
Right. So what is,
I wanted to jump in to just really quick. Do you mind if I jump in here? I just think it's interesting that, you know, you're right, like you call it the game, and the game is being dictated by Wall Street, basically, because the REITs are leading the way. They're being, you know, they're the puppets. Wall Street's been, you know, the puppeteer, and they've decided that this metric that they want to see is occupancy. And I believe you said something earlier about maybe the uneducated person about the industry. Like, they picked this metric and it's not the best metric. And so everything's being dictated by them. And so the REITs are following after that, because that's their true customer, right? That's the person they're dancing to their tune. And then when they come into a market, everyone feels like they have to follow the REITs, even though that is not the, that's not their customer, the independent operator, the tenant is, which is how it should be. Right. And so they're following this playbook dancing to the tune of Wall Street when they're not even on the stock market. And I just see it like this Pied Piper. And you had mentioned, you know, the game works initially. It's a short term. So a buzzword right now is healthy. So it's sort of like if I was to take an espresso shot right now, I would have a lot of energy, but I would have a big crash after that. Now, right. A healthy way to get energy is to get good sleep, to eat better, to exercise. So in the long term, what I just see happening is this was all illustrated in a book by Upton Sinclair called The Jungle, and what happened in Chicago, where businesses were not willing to self-regulate. And so I think that it's a dangerous game that we're playing.
Well, it absolutely is. And, you know, that's why I wanted to raise my hand back in January when I wrote the first article. I'm not trying to bring regulation to our industry. That is the last thing any of us wants. The funny point that I'll make based on what you just said is going back to what we were talking about earlier with the branding. The reason the REITs are able to lead the way is because they are the most efficient at collecting self-storage customers because of the size of their brand and because of how well they show up on Google. And so they are taking a large share of the people that are looking for self-storage. They're bringing them in to the game, which is what then brings us along to have to play the game, because we still need to get those customers as well and lease up our facilities or maintain our occupancy too. And so it's a real decision. And Jason, you said capitulation. At some point, that's where a lot of people get to. And you know, if you've got a fully stabilized facility and you don't have REITs in your neighborhood, no reason to capitulate. You're doing well. If one opens down the street or within your 2 to 3 mile radius, you would start to see your move-ins every month drop off because they are so efficient at coming in and gathering customers in a market. And they found it to be very successful to, you know, shockingly give it away.
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, it's still a little bit early for us. You know, we opened our first site here 15 months ago, second site 3 months ago. Uh-huh. But just to clarify, we do have many, many REITs within even 2 miles, pretty much all of them, as well as some other large regional operators, and they are priced quite aggressively. So we've got some of those challenges. Now, we don't have a massively oversupplied market. I realize that there's some markets that are pretty dire. But in terms of ours, I mean, the supply imbalance is relatively modest, but we are in lease up and we do have all the REITs. There's plenty of extra space and Publix and others, but I just don't want to go down that path, because once I go down it, you know, there's really no turning back. It's quite difficult. So we realize that we don't get all the rentals we could get otherwise, but you know, we have to spend time with our investors explaining, you know, how it impacts the lease up, and, you know, reminding them that we're focused on economic occupancy and revenue and, yep, not simply physical occupancy. So, I mean, everyone's got to do the strategy that they need to do. I mean, sometimes you've got to, I guess, hold your nose and do it.
Well, I mean, good on you for holding firm. And, you know, I always say, I don't need everybody in the market to agree with me. I just need 600 people in the market to agree with me and what I'm offering. And so, you know, for you, you build beautiful facilities and you just need 600 people to agree with you and find value at $175 10x10. You know, and I say it as, you know, you've got the Ritz-Carlton and the Motel 6. And I don't go into the Ritz-Carlton expecting to pay $39.99 a month or a night. Right. And so there is, that is absolutely true in self-storage. And if you build the product at the quality and you stick to your guns, you just need 600 people to agree with you and you've got a full facility.
I want to jump in. I thought it was interesting that you said the REITs, part of what they were using, the real estate that they were getting was tied to digital marketing and the SEO, right? And so it's interesting because our digital marketing partner, Storagely, has grown exponentially because that's their core competency is the SEO. So operators are realizing that, hey, in order to somewhat compete in this market, I have to have a good digital marketing strategy. And so that's interesting that digital marketing is really the key there in how they're dominating and then how they're, we're feeling like we have to play their playbook because they've dominated the Google space. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that's where we get the majority of our customers today, right? Drive by and the internet.
Totally.
And the good news for independent operators is you can beat the REITs in your individual markets on the internet still, not necessarily, you know, showing up first page, but from an SEO standpoint and pay-per-click, you can beat the REITs because you know more about your market than they do. They've got teams of people working on SEO and optimizing, you know, all of their location pages, but in kind of a cookie cutter fashion. Whereas a local operator, you can do blog posts about, you know, local events that the SEO office and you know, the REIT tower would never even begin to know about. And you have more information about your market than they could ever hope to have. And that gives you an advantage as a local expert, as far as Google is concerned, as a local expert on that specific market in that specific 3 miles that surround your self-storage facility. It's a lot of work, but it can be done and you can still compete, but you've got to have a team of people on it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's where we've, we kind of made a big bet on that 4 years ago, just in terms of our strategy. And we scrapped any paid ads and instead redirected all that money to, you know, SEO, which of course, as you said, it's labor intensive. It requires a lot of content creation, local blogging. So yes. As a result, in effectively every market that we operate in the US and Canada, so across North America, call it 30 locations, many large cities, some smaller cities or neighborhoods, on almost any geographic keyword, we're top five. So, you know, just to, you know, give others hope, I mean, even with a relatively small number of sites and locations, I mean, even on the Sunbird domain, there's only 2 locations. So even as a small operator, if you put in the effort, you can outrank many, many large operators on SEO. Like I said, top five, and in many cases, we're ahead of half of the big guys. So that's something that is possible. And part of it is because their strategy, of course, is to deploy lots of money and effort in ads. So right. On the organic search part, some of the large operators are not as strong.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from an efficiency standpoint for them, they've got the checking account to write the check.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're happy to do it. You know, that's one of the things at Store Local Storage. We have dedicated SEO people that only work on Store Local Storage stores for that exact reason, to try and give those stores the advantage against the REITs wherever we can.
So, Travis, I know we've been chatting for quite some time. I want to be respectful of your time. So given the current landscape, right, it's become, let's just say, even more challenging since the end of the pandemic. You know, the 2024 has been, you know, a battle for market share. There's a lot of, you know, smaller, certainly smaller or mid-sized operators that may watch this podcast. What would you advise them, kind of in closing, in terms of if you were a small operator with, you know, one or two locations, what would you focus on?
I'll go ahead and make the assumption that I have managers at the facilities, because I have managers at the facilities as well. The best thing that a small operator can do, and the best advice that I give for operators of one to two stores, is, like I was saying before, you have the ability to become the self-storage person in your community. So when someone needs a storage unit, I'm going to call Jason because he's my storage guy. And that manager can become that person in their individual market. That manager can go out, participate in community events. The company can sponsor, you know, banners on the baseball field and events at elementary schools and junior high schools and high schools. And the manager can be there, and they can be out meeting people and becoming the self-storage person when the need arises for that market in that hyper-specific, you know, 2 to 3 mile range of your facility. And no REIT will ever do that again. And that is the one thing that you can do as a small operator that they won't do, that will generate real rentals for you and build your brand within your 3 mile radius.
Yeah, no, that's really great advice. I know when I first got started in this business, I had sort of the, you know, large operator mentality that we would just kind of flood the market with digital marketing and everything would be taken care of. But, you know, after a couple of years, realized that we were missing some of those community connections. So
yeah,
redoubling the effort there, making it more personal, making it more local, that's definitely a huge differentiator versus, you know, any operator trying to run, you know, 500 plus locations just by a way of necessity. So that's fantastic right. Advice.
Yeah. You know, operators out there, take a look in your market radius. What schools, churches, and apartments are near me? I need to become best friends with all of those operations. And the associated potential tenants that come with them.
All right. Well, just super quick, want to say thank you for tuning in. Thank you for joining us on Storage Stories, episode number 4 with Travis Morrow. Thank you again, Travis. Really appreciate all of the great advice and, again, all that you're doing for our industry. So, listeners, if you would please hit the subscribe button on our YouTube, Storage Stories, and follow us on Apple Podcasts. Hit the like. Share out on your social media. We're so grateful for you listening in. We'd love to hear your feedback. All of our contact information will be in the show notes, so please feel free to reach out, introduce yourself. We really appreciate all the feedback that we have received and love to hear your comments. So also, please rate us, give us a review. We appreciate you. Thank you again, Travis, and hope you have a great rest of your day.
That concludes this episode of the Storage Stories podcast. Be sure to share and subscribe as we continue to tackle self-storage news, trends, education, and personal experiences from the competitive world of self-storage.